It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Teen and preteen years can be difficult under any circumstances. At times confusing, scary, exciting, you name it, for both kids and their parents or guardians. Now throw in the online world and social media where kids grow up in a lot of ways in public. A lot of parents wonder how to help their kids manage all that without becoming 24/7 monitors of their online activity. Our next guest has advice, and she says it starts with mentoring, modeling, and building trust. You could join in at 800-642-1234. How do you talk to your kids about what they do online? What questions do you have about how to talk to your kids about what they do online? Has having kids with the internet made parenting easier, harder for you? If you are a young person yourself or were recently a teenager, love to hear your experiences navigating the world of social media and how your parents may have helped or hindered that. Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Devorah Heitner is an author and speaker on technology and parenting in the digital age. She consults with schools about digital wellness policies and with app developers and tech companies on ethical practices. Her books include Screenwise, Helping Kids Thrive and Survive in Their Digital World. Her newest book is called Growing Up in Public, Coming of Age in a Digital World. Devorah, thanks a lot for joining us today.
I'm happy to be here.
Now, you write that you are like me, a parent who grew up before the social media age, where we could make mistakes and know that they weren't going to go viral. Is there kind of a communication gap between, you know, parents of the pre-internet generation and the kids growing up just swimming in this stuff?
I think there is. And there's absolutely a lot of worry on parents' part that kids can go viral. And I think because we all lived our own mistakes in middle school, high school, and even college, we're very aware of the sort of youthful, dumb, indiscreet things that might happen and that we know, you know, are kind of universally part of growing up even. And so it makes us really nervous. A lot of parents are very nervous to think about the fact that a video or a photo of, you know, your kid that their friend posts could become a huge problem because it's so much more searchable and shareable than anything dumb that we did.
You get a lot of questions from parents, you write, that are pretty nuts and bolts. You know, should I use this kind of monitoring thing? Should I bar kids from using this platform? Whatever. And we'll talk some about those things. But you, I think, started a more fundamental place about how to parent to prepare kids for dealing with these issues. A shift, you say, from consequences to building character. Can you talk about what you have in mind?
Absolutely. You want to think about not, you won't get into an elite college if you post that, because that's an external threat. And that's basically telling kids, don't get caught. What we actually want to say is don't do harm. Don't do things, you know, on Discord, on Instagram, on YouTube, on TikTok that are harmful, right? Don't malign a group of people or an individual. Don't do things that you know will cause hurt feelings or worse. Don't incite violence, right? And these are things that we know are really problematic. And we don't want to say, don't do it because Harvard might rescind your admission. We want to say, don't do it because we don't want to cause harm and we don't want to share things that might cause people to have the wrong idea about us and who we are. So if we can keep the conversation focused on character, it's more accurate, it's more developmentally appropriate, it's more true because frankly, you might do something that's pretty terrible and still get into an elite school and they just won't know. But that's, as a parent, that doesn't make me happy. I'm not like, oh, great, you got away with it. Right. The point is, who are you as a human being? So I think we need to shift that conversation to character and away from the threat of consequences.
I remember my teen years. I was not all that bright. I made dumb decisions sometimes impulsively. I'm sure if I had social media, I would have amplified them quite a bit. How do we work with a preteen or a teen to, I guess, take that step? To not be impulsive, to think about a consequence before doing stuff online.
It's tricky because it really does go against their neurobiology to not be impulsive. You know, teenagers are wired to think more about the rewards than the long-term consequences of an action. And so what we have to do is try to save them from themselves. And some of that maybe is not amplifying when teenagers make mistakes. We don't need to participate in amplifying that to reduce the harm factor. We can also look at things like in the UK and Europe, kids have the right to be forgotten. They can take things down that they posted when they were under 18. The realities of that with the internet, and I've talked to UK folks about this, it doesn't really fully work if your kid's involved in a tremendous scandal. It's still hard to pull that off the internet. But I do think the idea of thinking about not creating a permanent record of every dumb joke you ever said starting when you were 11 or 13 is a good one. And we as parents and educators in the US should be thinking about, like, what can we do from a policy perspective? Because the neurobiology and the technology, you know, intersect in a way that's pretty dicey for our kids.
One option people might think is maybe let's get out of the whole thing altogether. Say, kid, no device, no social media for you. Problem solved. What do you think of that approach?
I don't think that's a good strategy. I think kids need to know how to be citizens in digital communities. We can't just launch them at 18 and let them go off the deep end then. If anything, it's better to make your mistakes when you're young and learn about accountability in a digital community and communication strategies that work and how to resolve conflict when you're young enough to have a little bit more sort of forgivability, if you will, and a little bit less at stake. Like, say you're not going to hopefully blow up your career at 14, right? Hopefully that's,
I hope,
you know, still to come. So I think it's really important that we do teach kids how to be part of digital communities. I don't think we should push them in before they're ready, but I think school can be a great place to learn, for example, how to be part of a hangout or, you know, a shared document or other things in a community where you actually know the people involved before you get into digital communities where you don't know the other people, because that's sort of a next level experience. And ideally we can scaffold kids' experience growing more and more familiar with how to be participants in a digital community in a way that's appropriate.
Talking to Devorah Heitner about her new book, Growing Up in Public, Coming of Age in a Digital World. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your questions for our guest, maybe your own experiences as a parent or teen yourself. Join in at 800-642-1234. Devorah, I didn't end up doing a lot of monitoring with my kids. They're 20 now, so they're out the door. But I was amazed reading your chapter on options available for parents. There's a lot of ways to keep tabs on our kids online and social media and geolocation and so on and so forth. What do you recommend as parents survey that and think, yeah, maybe I should do this?
I think it's more important to talk to your kids and have a trusting, open relationship with your kids than anything else. And I think if you do monitor them, say you have a new phone user, I would do it with them. Like, if they're new at it and you want to look at their text with them, let's say, let's sit down together and look at your texts once a week or something until I see that you've got this. I don't think we want to use technology to surveil our kids. And particularly, we don't want to do it covertly. If we are monitoring, they should know we're monitoring. And in situations where they are being monitored by a third party like school, I do think it's fair to remind kids, hey, you know what, if you post this in the school Google chat, right, your teacher can see it. Like, I do think when kids are being monitored, they should know. If we covertly monitor our kids and go kind of all NSA, KGB on our kids, whatever, we are going to have a lot of data that we won't know what to do with. And the first time we share it with them, we're no longer covertly monitoring. We've ruptured trust. And we're often catching kids after they've made the mistake instead of before. What we want to do is teach kids how to make good choices, let them come to us if they've made a mistake that they need to kind of repair or move forward from. And we don't want to teach them that they can never repair a digital mistake. We've all made digital mistakes. Everyone listening to this has at least forgotten to BCC at some point and CC people and shared an email address with someone they shouldn't, or, you know, posted news on LinkedIn that wasn't public yet, or just something, right? I'm not saying, you know, tremendous digital mistakes, but we've all made some digital mistakes. And I think it's important that we don't teach kids that those can never be solved and they should be terrified, because in the most extreme scenario, that means that a kid who makes a digital mistake might feel desperate enough to contemplate ending their own life. What we want to do is obviously try to avoid the worst digital mistakes, talk to kids about planning for that, but also talk to them about how we can move forward and repair if we do share something we shouldn't.
One starting point that I loved in your book was not so much about what the kids are posting, but what the parents are posting about the kids. And of course, parents want to post baby pictures through graduation pictures and everything. You talk about the idea of, you know, negotiations as a family for what a kid is comfortable being posted about them and what they aren't. How do we approach that?
I think we need to be asking our kids' permission by the time they can talk to us and give it. And when they're too little for that, we should, if in doubt, not share it out. Picture that 3-year-old running around in their underpants being adorable as a someday very self-conscious 13-year-old who will not appreciate that video being out there. So, you know, if in doubt, do not share it out. And by asking permission from our kids, we're actually setting up really great boundaries, and we're teaching them that we respect their privacy, and we're giving them the opportunity to recognize that you ask permission before you share someone's picture, which is something we want them to know before they start taking and sharing pictures of their friends.
We're talking to Devorah Heitner about her new book. It's called Growing Up in Public, Coming of Age in a Digital World. You can join in at 800-642-1234. How have you dealt with this in your family, whether you're the parent or the kid, or a parent who used to be a kid dealing with these issues? What kind of boundaries, what kind of rules, what kind of conversations do you have in your household? What do you think about various ways to monitor kids' online activities? Do you need some advice from our guest? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also send us an email, ideas@WPR.org. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up our conversation with Devorah Heitner about a new book. It's called Growing Up in Public, Coming of Age in a Digital World, packed with advice for parents and teens and preteens about how to handle social media and the digital world. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Maybe you're taking our lesson to not share information publicly to heart, but if you have a story you'd be willing to share, like to share, you could join in at 800-642-1234. Did you have a difficult experience with a teen posting something online that maybe they shouldn't have oughta? How did you handle that? What kind of things did you do to prepare your kids, or prepare if you were the kid in this situation yourself? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. So what do we do, Devorah, when the bad thing happens? The kid posts something and it goes, you know, maybe not even internationally viral, but in their school viral or something like that, and causes harm and a lot of attention. How can we do some triage and try to fix things?
Yeah, I mean, I shared the story of the kids in Baraboo in the book, and some of you will remember that that's a situation where, you know, there was a photo in the community and some kids were making either white supremacist signs or a kind of Nazi Heil Hitler, you know, arm gesture, and it went around the world. And there are all kinds of ways that, you know, in the postmortem, we could think like they could have done better in that community to deal with what happened. But I think we all learn from situations like that. One of the tricky things is when something gets really big and it becomes national or international news, it becomes harder to have honest conversations in a community that might need to happen. Like, there were kids in that community who wanted to apologize and make amends and repair, which is what I think they should have happened and what in some cases did happen. And that's what I would want, you know, any kid to have the opportunity to do if they realize, like, wow, I made this significant error. I've hurt people by doing this. I want to come forward. But when it becomes a sort of media circus, it becomes harder because parents are like, want you to sort of stay away and hide. They don't want their kid to become known for this. So they don't want the kid to even come forward and apologize. So I think we need to make sure that kids have a way to make repair, make restitution as much as possible in the time and in the community where it happens. And then we need to let it go and move on, right? We need to make sure kids don't sort of pay and pay for the rest of their lives for like this one thoughtless moment, even though it's serious. Like, I'm not saying, and I want to be really clear, I'm not being an apologist for doing harmful things online or off, but I do think kids need to make the repair in the moment or in the community where it happens, not just a pro forma apology because they got caught, but really recognize and maybe do some further education as well for those kids. Maybe they didn't really understand the implications of referring to the Holocaust that way. Maybe the implications of white supremacy and the violence that entails weren't totally clear to them. And that's where we as school systems need to make sure we're showing up for our kids. When we see a kid use a slur or make a hateful gesture, we need to assume that they're the canary in the coal mine, and this is happening in a more widespread way in the community. And we need to make sure we're teaching kids the history of why those practices and words and gestures are so harmful. Not just focus all our outrage on that one kid, but make sure the entire community is addressed, and also make sure that the targeted community is supported, right? So we have a lot of work to do when a kid's mess up in that kind of way. And I think what we end up doing often is throwing that one kid or those group of kids under the bus and saying, oh, we had a racism problem here in Baraboo, but we got those kids. We found out those kids. Let's share their faces everywhere. Instead of saying, wait a minute, like, do those kids not know the history? Where did we go wrong? And what can we do to support our neighbors who are targeted by this gesture?
Another thing that struck me about a communication gap that we talked about earlier, Devorah, is you talk to a lot of parents and a lot of youth. Parents often will say things like, it sounds like kids don't care about privacy anymore. But then when you talk to kids, it's a lot. There's a lot more nuance to how they think about privacy. What do you hear when you talk to teens who are using social media?
Kids will say that a practice is creepy if they find it creepy. So they'll say, like, someone going through all your old posts when they're your new friend is creepy and liking a really old post. Or they'll say that their parents, you know, sharing pictures of them, or even worse, like reading their text is a real violation. So kids do care about privacy. The flip side is they're much more open about some things that in our generation were much more taboo and we didn't talk about. And that's one of the things I love about this generation is they are talking about mental health and other issues that we often kept private in our day. And even though, like, when I was a teenager, I did see a therapist, I never told my friends because I just figured it was taboo. Like, no one ever told me, no, don't tell anyone you have a therapist. I just kind of like got the memo because it was the 90s and nobody talked about going to therapy. And now I love that it's an option that kids could say, I'm going to therapy. And let me be clear that I think it's still fine if someone wants to keep and chooses to keep that private. But I love living in a world where so many of these things are more destigmatized and a kid could potentially say to their friends, oh, got to bounce, I've got therapy. And that's some of the kinds of things they're disclosing online where we might say, oh, they're oversharing. But I want to challenge adults who say that kids are oversharing to think about, are they oversharing or are they changing the culture in a more open direction?
Talking to Devorah Heitner about her new book, Growing Up in Public, Coming of Age in a Digital World. You also have a chapter in your book devoted to concerns about sexting, which is maybe taking that openness to do things online a little too far. What do you want parents to know and talk to their kids about when it comes to sending sexually explicit images?
Yeah, I mean, first of all, it's illegal, right? So we know that. But it's more important to lean into the privacy and the social risks with kids with prevention, but we don't want to lean so far into prevention with sending nudes or explicit photos that our kids can't come to us if they have shared a photo, especially if that photo then is reshared without their consent, right? So I think I want to be clear, like, you know, none of us really want our kids to do this, right? Mm-hmm. There's a lot of privacy risks, there's legal risks, there's all kinds of risks, but it's especially important that kids don't coerce other kids into doing it or be coerced. And the research shows that the kids who experience the most mental distress and anguish are kids who get coerced or kids whose photos are shared outside of the original intended audience. In other words, two kids who are in love who exchange photos might not make us as parents happy, and it's not technically legal. But if no one ever is the wiser, the mental health outcomes are often fine, right? I mean, there's still the same risks as if those kids did other things together in a relationship. But what's important to understand is when kids are coerced or their photos are shared to a wider audience without consent, that's a tremendous violation that can lead to a lot of mental health issues for kids and a lot of social issues and stigma. Unfairly, even in 2023, we see this land on girls more often, where girls are shamed for their picture going around, whereas some boys will share pictures and not get shamed, or boys will share pictures and girls will maybe find it yucky or block them but not report it. So there's just a tremendous double standard around this stuff. And I think we really need to proactively educate our kids around consent, making sure they know they should never coerce someone, that if they have had their photo shared and it's violating their privacy, that they deserve help and we still respect them. We're not so focused on prevention and shaming kids that we don't let kids know, hey, you have rights here. If your photo of yourself that you took and shared with one person that you trusted and that person violates your trust, they messed up and you have rights. And there are things that as an adult I can do to help protect you. I may never be able to get that photo back, let me be clear, but you know, we can get it taken down from any sites where it's been shared, especially because minors do have that right. And sites do not want to be hosting child pornography. So I think it's really important that our kids know that we still respect them, even if they've made a choice that maybe we're not jumping up and down about. If we lean too much into the fear factor with sexting, the worry I have as an educator and a parent is that kids won't come to us if they need us.
In just our last, a little over a minute or so, Devorah, one thing that often gets overlooked is that, hey, our teen years are times where we're experimenting with our identity. We're kind of trying on different things. And that's a lot of what is happening on social media. How big a part of the story is that?
It's absolutely part of the story. And one of the tricky things is kids will do things to get a rise out of their friends or be outrageous. You know, like I talked to some kids in Chicago who like, oh, it would be hilarious to like throw a gang sign and have a picture of me doing it. And they're not affiliated. They have nothing to do with any of that. But it's going to make them vulnerable to have shared that image. Right. I talked to a family where the kid had shared a picture of themselves with some vape stuff and the kid didn't even vape. He just thought it'd be hilarious to show with friends. And that's the tricky thing is with social, we're always talking to these different audiences and managing tremendously different contexts. And something that's funny to your three friends could get you in big trouble if someone else sees it. And that's so often what happens with social media. And it leads to, I think, tremendous misunderstandings and some consequences for kids that I think are often disproportionate to the intent of what they shared.
Devorah, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thank you. It's my pleasure.
Devorah Heitner is an author and speaker on technology and parenting in the digital age. We've been talking about her newest book. It's called Growing Up in Public, Coming of Age in a Digital World. Still time for you to share what you've done in your own family, lessons you might like to share with others. You can always email us, ideas@WPR.org. That's ideas@WPR.org. Remember, you can share this conversation if there's somebody who you would like to have listen to some of the lessons from our guest today. Find it in our program notes over at WPR.org or download the Wisconsin Public Radio app for live streaming and our extensive archives. I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time here on the Ideas Network. Listening to Central Time, I'm Rob Barrett. On Tuesday, Congress returned from its recess to complete the annual funding process. The deadline, the end of the month, or face a government shutdown. Senate committees approved their appropriations bills pretty smoothly, but negotiations in the House proving to be more difficult. Wisconsin Democratic Representative Mark Pocan was on the morning show on WPR yesterday and shared his thoughts.
You know, normally the appropriations process isn't this messed up. During the Trump presidency, we still had people on appropriations, the committee that I serve on that do the budget bills, were people who still were rational, I guess is the best way to say it, to get things done. So, you know, there's a saying that there's Democrats, Republicans, and appropriators. The problem is when Kevin McCarthy became speaker, part of the deal he cut in order to become speaker was he put some of the more extremist members onto the committee, and you know, they just didn't do their job this time for the first time ever.
Our next guest is a congressional correspondent here with us for a look at the roadblocks to a funding bill and yet another shutdown standoff potentially in the works. You could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have questions about how this annual government funding process works? Are you worried about the risks of a government shutdown? And in the House, do you want Republicans to use this process to negotiate things like spending cuts, restrictions related to abortion, and more? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Lisa Mascaro is the chief congressional correspondent for the Associated Press. Lisa, welcome back to Central Time.
Hi, thanks so much for having me.
We just heard there a Wisconsin Democrat diagnosing what could be the problem here. Representative Pocan making the case that it's what's going on within the Republican caucus in the House. It's a big part of the story, Lisa. What is going on there and how does it affect these spending bills?
Yeah, absolutely. The House is in a real tangle again. In fact, the chamber came to a standstill here this afternoon as there's just a lot of infighting over how they're going to try to keep the government funded. The core of the issue is the conservative flank, those hard right Republicans that really power the majority here in the House for Speaker McCarthy, they are refusing to give their votes to go along with the spending bills at the sort of level that they're being set at. They really disagreed with that big deal that Speaker McCarthy and President Joe Biden reached earlier this year. The two set the spending levels for the year. It was part of a big deal back in spring to avert a big crisis over the debt ceiling. And now that they need to start passing the bills to fund the government, the conservative Republicans are just saying, no way, this is not what we wanted then. We voted against it, and we're not going to let it happen now. And so Speaker McCarthy is really trying to float other ideas for how to get maybe some of the bills through the House. He's looking at trying to pass a big defense bill, maybe a homeland security bill. But even this afternoon, a test vote that was coming up on the big defense bill to fund the Pentagon and related defense needs here in the country, the chamber just came to a complete standstill because he doesn't have the votes. And of course, Democrats are not interested in voting for the bills that McCarthy is putting on the floor because they have a lot of policies in them that the Democrats oppose. You know, Republicans want to do away with just a lot of different policies that are important to the Democrats. In the Pentagon, for example, the Republicans are trying to strip out a lot of the diversity and inclusion initiatives that the Pentagon has tried to put in place. Republicans call these the woke policies that they're trying to get rid of. And, you know, so that just makes it hard for Democrats to come on board. So these are the challenges that Speaker McCarthy faces. And there's not really a way out at this point. There's just maybe 10 days when the House is in session before September 30th. And that's when government funding runs out and when we would risk a federal shutdown, but, you know, starting October 1st, if the Congress can't get these bills approved and get them up to President Biden's desk for signatures.
Let's give a listen to one of the members of the Further Right Freedom Caucus, about 45 members of the House. Here's Freedom Caucus Chair, U.S. Representative from Pennsylvania, Scott Perry.
We're here to put our foot down and say to this place right here, it stops now. The power of the purse is in the legislature. And the way you stop all this craziness of the Biden administration, the tyranny of the Biden administration, is to stop giving them money.
So that number I said, about 45 seats in the House with that narrow Republican majority you mentioned, makes it hard to pass things potentially. And there's been some talk from other members of that caucus that, like, hey, if we don't get what we want from Speaker McCarthy from our original deal with him, maybe he doesn't get to be Speaker anymore. How heated are things within the Republican caucus?
Well, that's exactly right. This threat of an ouster has hung over McCarthy since he won the gavel back in January. Folks might remember that was just a very contested vote. It took him 15 rounds day after day on the House floor to win the support from his own Republican majority to lead and to be the Speaker. When he finally won, he had reached an agreement with a lot of the holdouts, many of these same conservatives. And now they are holding him to those deals, and they're saying that he's not keeping up his end of the bargain. He faces this threat of ouster. It's not an idle threat. It is available to the conservatives. They have an ability through the House rules to file what's called a motion to vacate the chair. And, you know, they would need a majority of the House to vote for that. Now, they might not have a majority on the Republican side to oust Speaker McCarthy, but certainly Democrats might be interested in joining them on that. So it's a real risk. It's the tangle that Speaker McCarthy started his tenure with, and it's one that is hangs over him now through every step of his way here on Capitol Hill.
Talking to Lisa Mascaro, chief congressional correspondent for the Associated Press, about funding negotiations going on right now in Congress. Some roadblocks, as we're hearing, in the House. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you want to see come out of this? Do you worry about the risk of at least partial government shutdown if deals aren't reached? Should Republicans on the right and the Freedom Caucus hold firm, block funding bills unless their demands are met? What do you want to see from Speaker McCarthy? Should he continue to be Speaker McCarthy? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. Lisa, let's drop in on the Senate for a minute. I mean, it seems like, you know, it's not all love and harmony there, but it seems like the appropriations process is smoother on that side of the Capitol.
Well, yes, and this is fascinating. For the first time in a number of years, the Senate, sort of looking across the across the halls to the other side of the building, sees what's going on in the House. And this summer, they just started working together in a bipartisan way to pass the spending bills out of the different committees. There's 12 bills to fund the government. We don't often hear about those individual bills anymore because usually they can't. Neither chamber can get them out of their committees. Usually what we hear about are these big, you know, we call them omnibus packages that are a big wrap-up of all the bills. But the Senate, for the first time in years, did its work and passed each of these bills out of the committee, and now they're bringing them to the floor. They're kind of grouping them together in what we call a minibus, maybe three bills at a time grouped together. And it looks like they're going to start passing those in the Senate in a bipartisan way to get them over to the House and kind of pressure the House, you know, and say, look, we've reached agreement. We are working toward this agreement that the president and Speaker McCarthy, you know, had made last year. Some changes, some increases and shifts here and there. But for the most part, they're trying to work together to get that done and apply some pressure on the House. But as you heard from that comment from the chairman of the Freedom Caucus, Scott Perry, the conservatives in the House are in no mood to negotiate. And in fact, they want to work the other way and jam the Senate. You know, incidentally, we had news today with Senator Mitt Romney announcing that he would not be seeking re-election. And that shows you a bit of the frustration here in Congress that, you know, some of these longtime leaders, people that have really made a name for themselves in this country trying to, you know, be moderate or somewhat, you know, more moderate and trying to operate, you know, are experience the frustration and the concerns about the way these things are running here.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Dave is with us in Toma. Hi, Dave.
Yeah, hi. I think that they're just confirming that nowadays they're more interested in the welfare of their own jobs and the party than they are of the constituents.
And Dave, are you talking about Congress in general, or one party or the other, or the whole mess?
The whole mess nowadays.
Dave, thanks a lot for the call. I think Dave's not alone. Lisa, traditionally, Congress as a whole has very low approval ratings for the public. Is there a concern from members of the House about what this looks like to the public at large? Or, as our caller suggests, are they more worried about the people who are going to give them money and vote for them in their local district?
You know, it's a fascinating question, right? And I think we see, you know, all different takes on that. I think one thing, you know, for certain is that, you know, the country is facing a lot of, you know, a lot of issues, a lot of concerns. I mean, there's a big war overseas. There are new developments in technology. There are needs across this country. Anyone who's driven across the states see, you know, we are in a changing environment, a changing era in this country, and there's a lot of attention, and sometimes Congress does seem to be stuck in some of these constant battles over, you know, these kind of issues that maybe don't reach the broad scope of all the concerns out there that Americans might have, you know, trying to have jobs and be able to get their kids to school and ensure that the country is safe and that technology is safe and that there is, you know, good infrastructure and all those sort of basic needs that folks have, you know, yet Congress often is sort of fighting what might seem like battles that don't always seem to directly address what's going on with folks back home.
We're talking to Lisa Mascaro, Chief Congressional Correspondent for the Associated Press, about funding negotiations in Congress and the possibility of a government shutdown. And you could join in at 800-642-1234. Do you agree with Republicans on the Freedom Caucus looking for some spending cuts, policy changes before they sign on to appropriation bills? Is it worth the possibility of a shutdown? If so, what do you want to see from your representatives from Wisconsin over the next few weeks? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We're picking up our conversation with Lisa Mascaro, Chief Congressional Correspondent for the Associated Press, looking at this year's funding negotiations in Congress, the possibility of some form of government shutdown by the end of the month. You can join in with your thoughts. Questions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's go back to your calls now. Katie is with us in Marshfield. Katie, hi.
Hi. Hey, I have a comment about what these guys are doing in Washington and even in Madison. And my comment is this. Their jobs apparently don't seem to be very well defined, because I don't see that they're doing anything for the people who have voted for them. What about redefining what their duties are, for one thing? And then what about a national movement that says, do your job? Because they're not doing their job. That's not what we elected them for. And, I mean, how many of us would get to conduct ourselves in employment in the manner that they are?
Katie, so thanks. I gotcha. Thanks a lot for the call. Lisa, when I look at congressional elections each year, it seems like there's a majority of safe seats, some safe Republican and safe Democrat. There's fairly few members of Congress who have to look over their shoulder at the possibility that voters might toss them out.
This is true. The districts have just become so solidly sort of partisan in recent years, the past decade or two. You really see the firming up of sort of more Democratic-leaning districts on the left, more Republican-leaning districts on the right. I think we have about 15, 18 Republicans, for example, that are in districts that President Biden won, and just a handful of Democrats that represent districts that former President Trump won. So it really shows you how safe these seats are for so many people. For many of them, they're more concerned about a primary challenge, somebody more liberal or more conservative coming after them. And you really see that particularly on the right flank, where they do have more of these vocal and organized and energized conservatives on the farther right coming after the more moderate Republicans. And that is what's at stake for them as they try to make their decisions, knowing that they could be primaried at any time. And, you know, it is an interesting crossroads we're at. You know, Congress, you know, it's the first article there, you know, it's the first branch of government in many ways. It's the branch that is closest to the people. Needs to be representative of the people. That's the way our government was designed. And especially as we see the presidency becoming, you know, tumultuous at times with the different reach of executive power, both in former Trump's administration and the, you know, the efforts now in Biden's administration to sort of take charge where Congress has failed, you know, that gets into some really difficult terrain, because we are supposed to have a Congress that represents the people, passes legislation, and tries to move away from a sort of strong, you know, executive that can take charge in certain areas, you know, away from Congress, particularly in the spending, you know, in the power of the purse. And so it is important for people to sort of be aware of what Congress does and be informed about their member. Often you hear people say they like their member of Congress, the person who represents them. You know, they just don't like the others. And, you know, that is also a sort of difficult issue, because these guys all have to try to get along. You know, it's a big country and there's a lot of different regions, a lot of different needs, and a lot of different cultures within this country as they try to come together and figure stuff out that's best for the nation, you know, often with some difficulty to be sure.
Thanks a lot for the call, Katie. Peter is with us now in southeastern Wisconsin. Peter, hi.
Hello, how are you?
Good. What did you want to bring up?
Well, you asked if we're afraid of the government shutting down. I'm not afraid at all. From what I understand, they're going to continue giving Social Security and Medicare benefits. And, you know, I think there's only 5%, from what I understand, that would actually get shut down. And, you know, when Obama was president and this happened, he made it as painful as possible and shut down the national parks. Biden does not have to do that. And inflation is so high because we keep spending money from the government. So I think we really got to cut back. And if they have to shut down for a while before somebody changes things, I'm fine with that.
Peter, thanks for the call. And Peter, I think sharing the sentiment of some of the Republicans in Congress who are open to the idea of a shutdown. What Peter said, Lisa, is true. It's a non-essential functions, however that ends up being defined, is what would end in the case of the shutdown, right?
Well, yes and no. I mean, there are ways that they can try to stem the losses of the shutdown, try to eliminate certain aspects of government from being shut down. But that also takes some agreement from Congress, you know, to do it that way. And, you know, as we've seen, it's very difficult for them to agree on so many of these things. I was talking with Senator Lisa Murkowski late last week for a story that we did over the weekend. And she said, look, you know, I'll talk to you about a shutdown. She talked about federal permits that need to be provided to certain fishermen in Alaska who are starting their fishing season. And she said, during the last shutdown, you know, those permits couldn't be obtained and it really became difficult. So I think it depends. It depends on certain government agencies. And it depends, you know, we talk about trying to protect Social Security checks. Yes and no. At some point, you know, if the workers are told, you know, that they aren't to come to work because they won't get paid, then, you know, those checks wouldn't be issued. So it does depend, and it depends on how long Congress is willing to go to shut things down. You know, how many days? I think one of the longest shutdowns we had was something like 30 days. These things can be quick and they can get a resolution, or they can drag and perhaps cause more, you know, deeper pain than at the outset there.
Thanks a lot for that call. Just in our last few minutes, Lisa, what are you watching for next on these appropriations bills?
Oh, goodness. Well, I think for the moment, as we said at the outset, they've had to sort of shut down the floor activity today here in the House because the Republicans are unable to pass this big defense bill. They were trying to vote to launch that and they couldn't get it launched today because of the opposition from conservatives. So they've got one more day at work here this week, tomorrow. And I think we want to see if they're able to break the logjam and get it rolling, or if Speaker McCarthy is sort of back at square one and doesn't really have a plan B for getting these bills off the floor. It seems right now they're in a real jam up. So we've got to see overnight if they can get to some resolution here and get things moving again tomorrow.
Lisa, thanks for bringing us up to date today.
You bet. Thanks for having me.
That's Lisa Mascaro, Chief Congressional Correspondent for the Associated Press. We talked to her today about federal funding negotiations going on now in Congress, whether the holdup could lead to some form of government shutdown. Deadline end of the month. Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show with Kate Archer-Kent, Google is big and it does a lot more than search engines. Is it a monopoly? Federal antitrust regulators are making the case that Google is too big. Find out why and join in with your thoughts. You can get started right now. Ideas@WPR.org. Do you want to see antitrust action against Google and other big technology companies? Then join the conversation tomorrow morning at 8 on the Ideas Network. Have you seen a new movie lately? Have you seen one in an actual movie theater? The movie experience has been changing over the years, not just because of COVID. The big screen at the theater is competing with the screens we have at home. But the Barbie and Oppenheimer movies got a lot of people back into the seats. Tomorrow on the show, we're going to talk about the theater experience and whether it's making a comeback. You can get things started right now. Do you go to see movies at theaters? How often? What do you like about the theater experience? And if you stopped going to theaters at some point, what led to that? Was it costs, fancy home video equipment, the ability to pause the movie or make your own snacks? Let us know. You can email ideas@WPR.org. That's ideas@WPR.org. Or you could post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Then join the conversation tomorrow here on the show. See you at the movies, maybe. This is Central Time.